I invite you to open to Exodus chapter 4 if you haven't done so already, and that you would find that place or turn that on, whatever the case may be. If you're new to our church today or just recent, we are making our way through the book of Exodus, and I appreciate Colin who brought the word to you last week. My wife and I were away for a week for a little bit of vacation and listened to Colin's message. He did a fantastic job, and so I thank you for him for stepping in and covering that important passage in Exodus chapter 3. The title of this message is The Problem of Fear. Have you ever found yourself resisting the will of God in your life? Have you ever found yourself struggling with accepting God's call on your life? Have you ever found yourself scared to death that God was going to make you do something that you didn't want to do? Have you ever been afraid to follow God, thinking that if you follow him, it would mean the end of happiness for you and that your life will be a place of drudgery and misery? Have you ever just said no to God? Maybe even right now, saying no to him about something. The subject for this morning's message is really responding to God's call on your life. And 2 weeks ago, as we looked at Exodus chapter 2, I said to you that that chapter seemed to me, as I read it more and more, to be about partnering with God. And so this morning, we're going to continue that theme again. There are obstacles to partnering with God. One of them being that you can try to do God's work for him. We've seen that already in Moses' life. He went out and understood that the Lord was going to use him to deliver the people of Israel. And so he went out and he took matters into his own hand, tried to do God's work for him. He killed the man, and then he found himself that he needed to flee. We also found out in Exodus 3 that God isn't done with Moses. But there are other obstacles to partnering with God, and one of them being fear. Failure creates fear. And because we all have failure in our lives, therefore we all have fear in our lives. And because we fear, we tend to resist God when it comes to the call of God on our life. And that's what's going on in Moses' life at this moment. And so what we want to do is look at the problem or the obstacle of fear and how that gets in the way of God's call, God's purpose, God's aim for us. So what can we learn from this passage in Exodus 4? Now, I have to tell you at the beginning that this week, as I looked at this passage and wrestled with it, I had to make some rather challenging decisions about what I was going to do. And so I cannot cover everything that's in Exodus 4. And if you're wondering what in the world is going on with Zipporah and what she was doing and what she said, I'm sorry to say to you, I'm not going to answer that question this morning. If you want to know more, you can ask me afterwards. I'll give you my best shot. But we're going to look at Moses' dialogue with God and where he is as God has said to him, go back to Egypt. And Moses is in dialogue with the Lord, and he's had some honest questions about this assignment. The burning bush episode and God's revelation of Moses to Moses of himself, I am, the name of God, has shown him that God is not done, that God, in fact, does have a plan for Moses, and Moses is part of the plan. And Moses' dialogue so far has been to say, really, who am I that I should lead the people of Israel out of Egypt? And the second part that he asked God is, who are you, God? What is your name? Who do I say sent me? And those are really honest questions to ask. But in chapter 4, we come across where Moses really is, and that is the fear that is beginning to bubble up in his heart. And he has three that he puts before the Lord, three issues. We find them in verse 1, verse 10, and verse 13, and they're all set apart by the word but. They're all driven, Moses' questions to God, by his fear. In verse 1, we come across the first one where he says, "Then Moses answered, but." You ever done that to the Lord? "Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" And so what I want to do this morning is look at the three objections that Moses has to going back to Egypt. And so we'll look at each one of those in succession and what those are in his life. And then secondly, we're going to go back and look at the three signs that God gives to Moses and how those signs provide a provisional answer, a partial answer, but then how those signs actually provide a pointer to God's ultimate answer for Moses and for his circumstance. So three things this morning. Number one, looking at the problem of fear. Secondly, God's provision. And then thirdly, very simply, what it might look like for us in practicing our call that God has put on our lives. So the first one, verse 1, "Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice. They will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" What's the problem that Moses is facing right now? And it really comes down to the fact that Moses has a credibility problem that he sees. You see, Moses thought he was done. As far as he was concerned, he was a wash-up. He had messed up so bad that God was done with him. I'm sure he had a lot of evidence to go on. 40 years in the desert, no answer, no voice, no nothing. And even if God did want to use him, he couldn't. The last time Moses had tried to deliver the people of Israel, it had gone very badly. He had made a royal mess of everything. And what Moses is really saying to God is, "I don't have credibility with the people. It's been a long time, and they have surely forgotten about me. And if they haven't forgotten about me, they won't have any trust in me. And what am I supposed to say anyways? God spoke to me from a bush. Would you believe that?" Probably would say, "Moses, you've been in the desert a little too long, brother." So because of his fear, his first problem is a credibility problem. "No one is going to listen to me." Now, may I ask you a question? Do you ever have that same question in your mind? Do you ever struggle with speaking on God's behalf and thinking, "I have made such a mess of my life, and I have blown it so bad, no one is going to listen to me. Look at my past. How can I speak for God?" That's the first problem. Then in verse 10, we come across a second issue that Moses raises before God, and that is a capability problem. Look at verse 10. "But Moses said to the Lord, 'Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and tongue.'" So the first problem Moses has in mind is, "They're not going to listen to me." But now it's, "I can't do it because I am deficient." Now, we don't know if this was a real problem for Moses. We don't know if it was a real physical matter. Did Moses actually have a speech impediment? Did he have some kind of thing about his speech? Did he slur? Did he stutter? Or was it just a perceived problem? Did he just think of himself in this way? The actual verse, the way it's actually literally translated would be, I'm heavy of tongue and lips. Maybe Moses flunked out of speech class in the University of Egypt. And his professor said, Moses, it's not going to cut it. You have no future in public speaking. Either way, whether it was perceived or real, Moses was convinced that he lacked the ability in the precise area that God was calling him to serve him. May I ask you a question? Have you ever thought something similar? Do you ever think of yourself and say, I'm not smart enough. I'm not skilled enough. I'm not articulate enough. I'm not strong enough. I'm not whatever enough. You see, fear says to us, I have messed up so bad no one will listen. I have a past that nobody would listen to me about. But fear also says to us, I lack, and because I lack, I'm useless. The third problem that we see that Moses raises is in verse 13. It really is just a simple commitment problem. Down in verse 13, he said, But he said, oh my Lord, please send someone else. Have you ever experienced a situation, either in yourself or from someone else, where the reasons that are being given for why something can't be done are really just a smokescreen for something else? You ever done that? That's what we have here. Oh my Lord, please just send somebody else. You see, at this point, we get the raw, real Moses. Moses uncovered. The reason we find out finally at the end that Moses is resisting God's call to go back to Egypt is because he just doesn't want to go. To commit to that would require enormous change for Moses. Number one, God is going to be in charge. Number two, he'd just rather stay where it's safe. He'd rather stay where it's predictable, where he can control his environment. May I ask you, have you ever been there? Have you ever felt like, I want God in my life, but only at a distance. Not the up-close personal God who calls to me, who pursues me, who won't allow me to stay where I am. And to commit to him would require enormous change in my life. And frankly, I'm just scared to death of what that might mean. And so I would rather just stay put right where I am. You ever been there? Moses was there. And if you're a person like Moses this morning, who thinks, I have a past, and so I am not credible. And I have a whole long list of deficiencies in my mind, and so I'm not capable. And I'm just flat scared of allowing God to be in charge, and so I really don't want to commit. If that's you, I've got good news for you. The Lord delights to work with those kind of people. As far as Moses could see, he was a colossal failure. And God said, "You're my man. That's who I'm going to do my work through." But at this point, brothers and sisters, I would like for you to understand something absolutely critical. It could go one of two ways in Moses' life. He could say, "No way. I am not going back there. You can forget it." Or he can step out and trust God and experience the power and the grace of God. But you know what it's going to take? The willingness to obey. And that is exactly where every one of us are too. Moses does so only after the Lord provides a concession. Aaron, your brother, will be there. He'll help you. And Moses finally goes, albeit reluctantly. I am sure that on that trip from Midian to Egypt, Moses was quaking the whole way. Every step was a challenge. But then we find that God gives to Moses some provisions, some partial answers for his situation, some partial answers that will deal with his moment. But I also want you to see this morning that those partial answers, those provisional gifts that God gives to Moses that will provide him the stability, the strength to be able to know the Lord really is with me, point towards God's ultimate answer. See, the question that we have to ask is, how can Moses fulfill his calling? And the answer that the passage gives to us, that we will see in a moment, is only if he does it by the means that God provides. God is calling Moses to do something far beyond his capacity or ability. And the only way that he's going to fulfill that calling is if he does it by the means that God provides. And I want you to know this morning that the same is true for you. God will call you to do things that are beyond your capacity and ability. And the only way that you can fulfill the calling that God puts upon your life is if you do it by the means with which he provides. Moses is given three proofs that God has in fact sent him to deliver the people from Israel, from Egypt. It is helpful for us to realize in the passage that these proofs are called signs and wonders. At the end of chapter 3, the Lord says to Moses, "I will do my mighty wonders in the midst of the people." And then in chapter 4, he talks about these three signs. Someone has said so very helpfully, "A wonder is something that halts people in their tracks, making them stop and stare. A sign points beyond itself to something else. A wonder is meant to catch our attention. A sign is meant to engage our minds. A wonder astonishes, but a sign instructs." And so these three are given to Moses as wonders and signs. It's a very important principle to understand because in Jesus' own ministry, the same was true. The signs in John's gospel, he says, "I wrote these down because they signify something. You're to come to conclusion about who Jesus is through these signs." And so what do these ones teach us, these three that he has given? He's given three. And he's given them, the text says, so that the people of Israel will believe that God has in fact sent Moses. And on one level, they actually do accomplish that. The people see the signs. It convinces them that the Lord has spoken to Moses. And at the end of the chapter, it says that they bowed down and they worshiped. The Lord does intend to deliver them. But we need to ask of the text, what do the signs mean? What do they point to? And so let us consider those this morning. Number one is Moses' staff. Moses says, they're not going to listen to me. They're going to say, the Lord did not appear to you. And God says, what's in your hand, Moses? A staff. Throw it on the ground, Moses. He throws it on the ground and it turns into a snake. Now, Moses, reach out and take it by the tail. That's an interesting fact. You never grab a snake by the tail. It required obedience and trust, didn't it? Take it by the tail, Moses does, and it turns back into a staff. What is the significance of that? What is going on? Why is God doing this particular thing in this way? Well, first of all, we should notice and see that God has the power to take something ordinary, like a shepherd's staff, just what Moses happens to have in his hand, and use that thing as his instrument, his chosen instrument of God's power and deliverance. Nothing amazing, nothing significant, but God can use it to bring about great acts of deliverance. You see, who fears a shepherd's staff? Moses walks into the very presence of Pharaoh with nothing but a staff. Who fears a shepherd's staff? And yet in the hand of God, that shepherd's staff becomes so prominent in deliverance, the deliverance of the people of Israel and in the Exodus. But then a second question, why a snake? And the answer to that is really twofold. You see, on the one hand, at the first level, the snake in Egypt was a symbol of power. On top of the head of Pharaoh was the insignia of a snake, and in his hand, a scepter with the snake head on the top. You see, the snake was quick and deadly. And so it became a symbol of power. And by changing that staff into a snake and then back again, what God was saying to Egypt and to Moses and to the people of Israel is, I rule over the power of Egypt. And it is being done, my power is being done through my servant Moses. But then also, we have to ask a little deeper question. And that is, what is the serpent in the biblical story? You see, the serpent in the biblical story is the form that Satan took in the garden. And when God has that staff turn into a serpent and back again, what is he saying to Moses? God is saying to Moses, I have authority and power over Satan himself, who is your true enemy. You see, Pharaoh is the one that you see, but your real battle, your real struggle, Moses, is not so much with Pharaoh, but with Satan himself. And you need to understand, Moses, that you cannot defeat Satan with physical human means. There are no physical human means that can defeat the power of Satan. It takes the power of God to defeat the serpent. And so then we must ask the question, well, what is the power of God? How, in fact, does God defeat Satan? And so we come to the second sign, the leprous hand. God says, Moses, stick your hand inside your cloak. And he pulls it out, and it's leprous. Now put it back and pull it out, and it's been restored. And what is kind of missed in our translations is it's not just that the hand is meant to go inside of his clothing, but it actually says, put your hand in your bosom. Why did God do that? You see, to get leprosy or some kind of terminal skin disease was incurable in their day, as often it is in our day. And in the worldview of Egypt, it took the power of the gods to avoid disease. And if one got a disease, it was a sign of judgment from the God that you had done something wrong. And to get an incurable disease, all you could possibly do was hope to offer some sort of sacrifice to the gods and hope that it might appease them and that they might bring some sort of healing. No one would have expected that to contract the disease and then to be healed immediately by this sign. God is saying to Moses and the people that not only does he have the power over Egypt, but also the power to heal over disease. But then notice also where Moses has to put his hand. Into his bosom. Here's what the Lord is saying to Moses. Moses, your true problem is not external to you. It's not just Pharaoh. Your true problem, Moses, is not your speech problem that you think disqualifies you. Your true problem, Moses, is that you have an incurable disease of the soul. And no amount of personal rehabilitation, no amount of self-help classes, no amount of anger management classes, no amount of fleeing to another country, no amount of taking up a new career can cure this. You see, having the power of Satan and buying the lie of Satan that we bought in the garden, that you can be your own gods, to have that power cannot, in your life, cannot be defeated through human means. It takes the power of God to defeat the power of Satan. And only the power of God to heal and to restore. And so then we ask the question, how then does God heal and restore? And then we come to this third sign. Moses, if they won't believe these two signs, take a bowl of water, a bowl, and dip it in the Nile and lift it up and pour it onto the ground and it will turn into blood. Now, why did God do that? You see, what was the significance of the Nile? Well, if you live in an arid land like Egypt, the Nile is the source of life. The Nile in Egypt, in Egyptian mindset was, it brings life. Every year the rains come, the Nile comes to life. It brings, and everything around it has life. And by changing the water to blood, God is demonstrating his power over the Nile, which the Egyptians saw as their source of life. But why to blood? And the answer to that is to show that true life is found in the blood. You see, restoration and healing of the soul, that can only come through the blood. And so there is no way for us to defeat the power of Satan by human means. Put it another way, there's no way to go back to the garden, to the place of innocence. There's no way to get back there and to undo the deed that was done. The only way is to go forward into God's provision of healing and restoration. And do you know how God does healing and restoration? He does it through the blood. And so that's the partial answer that Moses gets. But what is God's ultimate answer? It doesn't answer every question. It moves Moses along so that he can fulfill his calling. It gives him some inclination and understanding into what is really going on in this circumstance. But how does God deal with our fears so that we can fulfill our calling in our partnership with him? You see, Moses was used by God to deliver his people. But don't you see how Moses was afraid? He believed, he was convinced that if God sent him there, they wouldn't listen. He was afraid to go. It might work out that they wouldn't listen to me and they wouldn't want anything to do with me. And yet Moses found out that when he got there, because God was with him, that his fears were unfounded and that the people did listen. And that the people did begin to follow him. Oh, there was lots of trouble, which we will see. But they listened and they followed him. And Moses did become the deliverer whom God used to bring the people out of Israel, out of Egypt as the Exodus. Through those signs, it authenticated his message. But brothers and sisters, when Jesus Christ was sent by God, he knew before he left heaven that they will not listen, that they would not believe that he was sent by God. He knew that that would, in fact, be the outcome. And yet he came anyway. Moses was afraid that they would reject him, but Jesus knew for certain that they would reject him. Moses went reluctantly, but Jesus knew that they will not believe that I was sent by God. They will not listen to the message that I have from God. That they will, in fact, reject me. And with all of that knowledge ahead of time, things that Moses was only fearing might happen, though Jesus knew would happen, and yet he came. And isn't it interesting that all throughout Jesus' ministry, he never carried a staff? All of his ministry was done. All of the signs and wonders which Jesus did, he did by the power of his word and his touch. The great I am. Except for one place. Oh, how fascinating it is that in Matthew chapter 27, verse 26, the passage says that they put a crown of thorns upon his head and a staff in his hand. And they took that staff and they beat him over the head again and again to mock him. You think you're one sent by God. And then they lifted him up and put him on a stick where his blood spilled where? Down upon the ground. Why? Why? So that you and I could experience the healing and the restoration that we need. So that we could be restored, not externally, though that happens as well, but so that we could go back to innocence. You see, all those people who look to him and see God's message, God's sent one, God's deliverer upon a stick. And you know what's amazing? God took something as banal and ugly and ordinary as a cross, and turned it into the most life-giving reality that the world has ever known. God uses not a staff, but a wooden cross, a symbol of weakness, nothing extraordinary, and he turned it into the most life-giving source. You see, through that, all the power of God can flow right into your life. And what's amazing about the cross is just like the Nile River, all of your sin, all of the junk, all of the past can flow right away from you and be taken out of your life. And what flows in is the life of God. Through that simple instrument. And so this morning, if you take that into your life, do you know what will happen? It will deal with all the fear that you and I have. You see, first, our credibility will be healed because it's not your message anyways. It's God's message. It's not your past. It's Jesus' past. And you know what's in Jesus' past? Perfection. Absolute purity. Absolute righteousness. Nothing at all of even a hint of the ugliness of sin. And if that comes into your life, it's his story of purity, his story of righteousness that flows right into your life. And so, it's not your credibility at all. It's his. And your capability is healed too, because it's not your capability that matters in the first place. God told Moses that he would be with his mouth, but through Jesus Christ, God tells us he will be within us. His very spirit, the great I am who spoke from the bush, will be within you. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this surpassing power comes not from us, but from God. You see, what's astonishing is that God never evaluated Moses' speaking ability. He never said, oh, Moses is not that bad. He never said to him, you can do it. Just dig deep. He never even admitted what Moses said was true or not true. All he said was, Moses, I will be with you. And in the gospel of Jesus Christ, Jesus says to you, I will never leave you or forsake you. Behold, I am with you to the end of the age. The only question that you and I have to answer is, do we believe that God is big enough to follow him and do what he has called us to do? Do you believe that God is big enough to fulfill what he has called you to do? And are you willing to trust him that he's faithful enough to do it? That's the only question that we have to answer. And you know what? Your commitment to follow him can be healed as well, if you're willing to step out and walk in obedience. Francis Schaeffer once preached a sermon called No Little People, No Little Places. In it, he said this, consider the mighty ways in which God used a dead stick of wood. God so used a stick of wood can be a banner cry for each of us. Though we are limited and weak in talent, physical energy, psychological strength, we are not less than a stick of wood. But as the rod of Moses had become the rod of God, so that which is in me must become the me of God. Then I can become useful in God's hands. The scripture emphasizes that much can come from little if the little is truly consecrated to God.